Hi, I'm Yoel Israel, and I'm your host of Israel Tech. I'm really excited, actually, to have with here Avery Schwartz, a partner at Greenfield Partners. One of the reasons why I'm really excited is that this helped make a little bit proof of concept for me. One of my very first interviews was at a cybersecurity company, and one of those VCs that walked by was Avery, and we made small talk. And through that, I was like, this is the kind of person I need to have on. And so this has come full circle already in probably 3.5 months. And so since then, I'm happy to have you on. Thank you, Avery.
Thank you for having me on, and it's great to be here. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a beautiful office. So the first thing I want to understand, I'd like to get into, is what exactly is Greenfield Partners? I do want to go into your career and what you've been doing. You do have some unique experience as an investor through different components of your career, not just in venture capital. But really, what is it about Greenfield Partners that makes it different than other VCs?
Sure. So I guess the main thing I would point to is the stage at which we invest. So we invest at a stage that we call early growth. Typically, if you think about series, you'd think about series B, series C, a company that, you know, from a revenue perspective, usually between 3 to 5 million, up to about $20 million in revenue or recurring revenue, ARR, as it might be referred to. And, you know, really the company's coming into a specific point in the business where, you know, it's found product market fit, it's been really nimble of going out to the customer, getting feedback, bringing it back to the R&D team, and they've, you know, now found what's called product market fit. But then the stage that they enter is, okay, now you have to build a machine that builds on that product market fit. Maybe it's called product motion fit. So you build a whole motion into going to the market. How do you capture leads? How do you move them down the funnel? How do you enable the salespeople? What does the building of that sales team look like? And how does the handoff look like with customer success? And who's doing upsells and things like that? That's a whole different science and a challenge that the company then faces. And so we're trying to build our expertise around supporting companies during that phase, and that's how we've built the infrastructure of our fund.
Was Greenfield always intended to be at Series B, C after there was product market fit?
Yeah, so in our history, we were originally set up by a large US-based private equity fund called TPG, and they have a growth fund, and we were under that umbrella up until 2019 or so when we spun out of TPG. But even back then, we were kind of investing one or two clicks earlier than TPG, which was, you know, more kind of, you know, traditional growth fund investing, I guess, Series D, Series E, minimum check size of $50-$7,500 million. And so we were always investing a little bit before then.
So what is it about this stage that makes it unique? Because a lot of people say, obviously, the smaller you go, the more seed, in a sense, before the product market fit, obviously there's more opportunity for bigger growth, bigger returns. On the other hand, there's more risk, more reward. Do you think in general, from an investment perspective, from a risk and reward, this is a sweet spot? Or is this, do you feel that you have more expertise and understanding or better relationship with those in that stages that you can help better?
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of zooming out, I think that any stage is interesting if you know how to do it well. And you see, you know, Israel is a great example of some tremendous seed investors who've done really well, make great returns, because if you do that well and you have the right pattern matching ability of the founders and taking a bet on the thesis and the size of the market, you can do great. Yeah, I think it just takes a little bit of a different skill. I think we've kind of built the expertise of, you know, our own kind of pattern matching at this stage, which I think is different. A lot of people will acknowledge that it's different than the early stage. You have a lot more factors that you're able to evaluate and take into, you know, a consolidated view of assessing that risk reward, because ultimately you want to optimize that trade-off, take as little risk as possible and optimize for as much reward as possible, which is difficult. But I think that focusing on that stage and doing it over many years has allowed us, you know, is very helpful. And then orienting the fund in order to be able to, in whatever way possible, help influence that outcome is great as well, which then feeds back into the kind of the sourcing element, because then, you know, the best founder will hopefully see in you a really good partner to kind of build the company with.
So when you go ahead and make an investment, what percent of your investment usually goes into R&D, engineering, and what goes into marketing and sales?
Ooh, that's a good question, because a lot of what we focus on is really that go-to-market machine. But I think that, especially at this stage, you can certainly not ignore product and R&D, and that's definitely an integral part of our thesis and underwriting. Ultimately, the split is determined by the company. at these stages, I would say, you know, sales and marketing is often just starting to eclipse, you know, R&D and G&A. So from a breakdown, it's that, but we're not the ones who'll dictate it. You know, the company is, you know, management will dictate what the, you know, the board will approve the budget, but management is still dictating, you know, how much to spend on the different items. But our focus will be on, you know, that helping with the go-to-market function, but also being partners to the thesis and what the company's trying to build and how they're thinking about Act 2 and Act 3 of the business.
So when you're saying that it usually eclipses at this point, that we're spending more on marketing and sales than usually the product at about this time, is there sometimes management challenges of the founders that in a sense, like the business is changing from building something to now go to a market they may not be familiar with, trying to scale, et cetera. What kind of challenges do you come by with the founders? Because in a sense, these tech businesses, they change a lot, how they're operating and what their conversation, their internal meetings and conversations are switching more towards building the product market fit, okay, scaling, who are we reaching, going to more events, et cetera. Are there any challenges with the founders that you're speaking with? Because they're kind of almost in the sense their roles change.
Yeah, and we could probably spend a half hour just on that.
We got time.
I would abstract it into, I guess, one point, which is, I think the types of founders, especially in Israel, we've spent most of our time, they're amazing at recognizing excellence in technology and product. And I think that's a really important part of building a company, is knowing what excellent looks like. And they're amazing when it comes to the technology and R&D and product side. I think where, you know, sometimes that change manifests itself is, you know, even second and third timers, do they recognize what excellent looks like on the go-to-market side? And I think that in this type of, you know, startups are hard, the power of gravity is very strong, and the difference between, you know, a B-plus team and an A-minus team is actually very significant. And so if you're off on understanding, like, how great of a team you're building and what does excellent look like and how do I, you know, what are the best, you know, leaders of my go-to-market organization, not just from a, you know, VP perspective, but directors and account executives and positions like that, you will not be growing optimally and not be leveraging what you've built to date, and you'll lose, you know, crucial time and capital, and, you know, there's a cost of capital associated with that. And I can expound into some of the things that we've been doing, especially lately, in order
Go ahead. Yeah, and I'd also like to hear the challenges involved that you think the founders have when they bring in someone like you at the stage of BC for scaling growth. What kind of challenges do they have? And I want to hear, yeah.
Yeah. So I will say that the kind of the culture of the firm is very much informed by the founding partner Yehuda Doron and our managing partner Shai Grinfeld, both of whom have operating experience. So they did a lot of what our CEOs are doing today. And although Raz, my partner, and myself have more of an investment banking background, I think that we're very much informed by this perspective that, look, operating a business is hard. Things go bump in the night. It doesn't always follow the Excel. And really being empathetic and understanding and trying to work with companies from an operator mindset has really kind of been embedded in the culture of the fund. So I'll just say that for one. And the other point I would mention is we were fortunate enough to have joined us recently an operating partner, Nir Goldstein, previously VP sales at Monday.com. And when you think about if there's one of the top SaaS companies worldwide in terms of that, the efficiency that they went to market with and what they built on the go-to-market side, and Nir being integral to that, building it from when he had, I think, you know, 7 quota-bearing reps when he joined, and he left leading about 180.
That's awesome.
So you talk about who understands what excellent, what an A-plus looks like, and through that growth and incredible scaling. So he has what I think a lot of the founders want in terms of being able to bring that excellence to their organizations. And we're seeing it already in the short time he's been with us, tremendous pull from both our founders and other founders in the ecosystem. And I think that's very much aligned with what we're trying to bring to our companies and the ecosystem.
Yeah, my company, Watt, has been using Monday.com forever. I think it was like called The Pulse.
That's right.
Right before that. And what's actually fascinating, a lot of these huge companies that really scale, let's say like Monday did, they create so much expertise and talent, becomes a school in of itself. And then those that go and leave are able to do so much more for our greater tech ecosystem here, here in particular. So when you go into investing, one of the things at your stage, there's already companies that have invested before. How does that relationship work with other VCs, those that came before you? Do they have more say? Do they maybe bring you in because maybe you can bring more support at a certain stage? Is there like responsibility baton handing over? How does it work when you come in?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, what we always try to do is we want to come in and have a great relationship with the board, constructive relationship. We want to make sure there's alignment. And so we're not often not just talking with the founders, we'll be talking with the board members as well to ensure that alignment. I think in an ideal scenario, there will be kind of an expectation that, you know, we are coming in at a certain stage and we should have an expertise at that stage. And they've been, if we're investing, they've probably done an amazing job at what they're good at. And
right.
They would expect us to do a great job.
So it's like a baton handoff. In a sense,
you know, I think they're still, you know, in a lot of our cases, those funds are still very much involved. I don't feel it is a baton handoff. It's more of an extension of the...
It's like you're married into the family.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how it kind of feels.
What do you, in addition, of course, to you interviewing the founders and the founders interview, getting to know each other, make sure it's a good fit, at what point does the board come in to make sure you guys are a good fit and vice versa, and make sure there's also not just good fit as organizations, but the individuals, the personalities involved in the board? Can you walk us through how that, like, chronologically, ideally, kind of like what that goes through when you're considering investing? Who do you speak to, in what order, who interviews whom, what do you look out for, what do they look out for when they're asking you, if you both as organizations and within the individuals that will serve on the board?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the way I view it is you kind of have to look from the decision point outward, right? So the decision point is when the founder will sign a term sheet after having received approval from the board. And then kind of working backwards from there, in order to get to that point, that will mean that, you know, from our perspective, we have actually, we looked at our CRM to see this. We know founders on average 26 or 27 months before we sign a term sheet with them. You know, sometimes it could be less, it could be more, but.
Wait, you're talking to them for over 2 years?
Yeah.
Before?
Yeah.
But like, that's intentional. You're like, hey, we see, like, let's say, because maybe when you're trying to connect and network with them when they had the round before.
Exactly.
And you're like, okay, this is interesting. They just raised with this VC.
Yeah.
They're in this space.
Correct.
Let's go get coffee and start to nurture that relationship now. So if they're at the point in the future, we can be there to help and partner. Is that your strategy?
Exactly. We don't want to be, I think that, you know, part of our advantage of, you know, having an office in Tel Aviv is, you know, being local to the ecosystem and being able to cultivate these relationships. And so not parachuting in and trying to, you know, compete in a 4-week process and without any real context.
When you say that, you're referring to American or foreign?
I'm referring to just an alternative if we didn't have this type of ability to build a relationship.
Right. Got it.
You know, and so that's super important because, you know, these are founders that, you know, these are long journeys, both with the founders and with the other board members. And I think over the course of time, you can kind of see if there's an alignment of values. You know, you might go into different areas where, you know, interests can diverge and you need to rely on an alignment of values in terms of how you navigate some of those. You know, not everything is always up and to the right, right? So I think that's very important for us. So I think during that process, we get to know the founders and the founders get to know us. I think the founders are evaluating us just as much as we're evaluating them. They want to see, is this a fund that can support us? Do they get it? Is this someone that I want to work with and have sit on my board? Are they aligned with my values? And I think the board members, it's a mix. You know, some of it is just, you know, it could be even many, many years in the ecosystem, much longer than the 2 years with the founder because you might have been working, right? And it depends on the board. Some are like super intimate. Some are you kind of get to know over time. But I think at the point that you start to feel like a deal cadence, So for obviously 2 years prior to its relevant, it's a very different cadence. It's okay, let's catch up once a quarter. You know, we'll do some thematic research. We'll say, hey, you know, we've been doing some work on your space. We'd love some feedback from you, and maybe we're going to publish something. And so try to have it a little bit more substantive. But at a certain point, it gets to a deal cadence. And at that point, you want to make sure that you're, you know, talking with the other board members and ensuring alignment there as well.
What are red flags?
Good question. You know, we use this phrase, and I'm not sure if we stole it from Ariel from CoreLogic. So apologies if
I thought you stole it from you, but whatever.
But we look for in our team as well, kind of people who are hungry, humble, and smart. And you know, I think that people who look into our portfolio tend to say, oh, like there's a certain like typecast of founder who kind of also kind of fits that bill. Look, there have been great companies built by people who aren't quite like that, and that's fine. I think for us, you know, we see not only just an alignment and it being much more pleasant to build a big company with someone who has that humility, we actually see some of the best founders being also the most humble, and for sure, you know, hungry and smart, because they're able to empower others. And so when we take it back to the, you know, the first principles that we're discussing, our stage, you know, if you have that amazing charisma and you're, you know, a one person show, you can get through the seed and A stages and create business. But in order to unlock real scale and build a company, you're going to need to be able to empower other people. And it's generally the people who are more humble that have the ability to empower others, make them feel that ownership and that power, and they can shine and create great functions. And so you need your sales leader to step up, the marketing, the customer success, you know, the VP R&D can't feel constrained. And so we actually see a correlation between the founders who have that sense of humility and who are able to actually unlock real scale in the business.
How are you able to tell that within a meeting, someone for the first time, that they're humble? What are you looking for? Or is it more red flags that tells you that they're not humble? Or is something that like you're looking for in particular that you go in with like, my agenda is to find out, you know, obviously their personalities, their chemistry, but also are they humble? Are they a team worker? Are they more leader or manager? These like, what are the, if you could speak to that.
It's a good question. I try not to judge too much on one meeting. I think in general, the way I see is like, you have to have a lot of touch points in order to kind of coalesce around a certain point where you feel like, okay, you kind of get the person. And so it kind of looks like this, but over time, the way I judge it is like, what's the delta in your impression on the basis of new information, right? In the beginning, you can go, there's like big deltas every time, right? But eventually you have enough information where you might learn something that's okay, move my opinion a little bit. Like, okay, then you feel like you're kind of at the right place. You kind of know the person. So that's why we want to get to know people over time, because anyone can have like, you know, I can come off as, you know, in one way in a meeting, and you know, I'd love for people to also get to know me a bit better before judging me. So that's one thing. One thing you'll see in terms of relating to the factor I mentioned before is, you know, letting other people speak. You know, I think that's something that sometimes you'll even see, even the body language. You can see like when another team member is speaking, are they tensing up, right? Are they worried about what that person's going to say? There can be reasons for it sometimes, but, you know, sometimes it could be like a little bit of a signal that, you know, this is not a person who's going to be able to empower others as well. So that's one. Being a good listener is like, I just think that's super important, because I think it also translates to how people listen to the market and to feedback and things like that. Again, that just relates to, it's a proxy for, I think we're big believers that, you know, like there's an objective truth out there a lot. And, if people are not good listeners, don't necessarily acknowledge that, and they'll want to kind of believe something else. And if you believe something that's not aligned with this sort of objective truth, then the actions you take to on the basis of that aren't going to be optimal, right? And so even if a truth is harsh, better well object it, listen closely, acknowledge, and then take actions on the basis of that, because that'll be, otherwise that problem will still fester and it'll get bigger. So I think being a good listener is really key as well.
Do you think I'm humble? Let's see how good he is.
You know, you're in this conversation, you're the ultimate listener. So I'm the one who's
They're listening.
Yeah.
So let's not be humble for a minute. And let's talk about some of the great companies that you represent. Full disclosure, my company, Wadi Digital, has actually served many of them, particularly your cybersecurity client, your cybersecurity portfolio companies. But maybe you want to talk about, because you have a lot of very successful companies. So maybe if you want to speak a little bit about kind of them, I know there's been some big things in the news that was since before we actually scheduled this months ago. So maybe if you kind of want to talk about that and give us a little glimpse into what we could expect in the future, given the hard times we're finding ourselves in the middle of a war, kind of about what we could expect and if we can kind of get any visibility into the Israeli tech ecosystem in the rest of 2024 and in the future, accordingly from the experience that you have.
Yeah, sure. I think we have great portfolio companies. You can see on our site the full list. I think maybe I'll just touch on two that have been in the news recently. One is Vast Data, which raised capital in a round led by Fidelity at a valuation of $9 billion. That's been just an amazing ride to experience. Feel very fortunate to be a small part of that journey. I think it represents some of kind of the best that the ecosystem has to offer in terms of, tremendous technologists that, have been building something truly differentiated in that, the data infrastructure category. They're building a data platform, which is, really has, an exciting base on which to build really differentiated technology that can serve just a massive, massive potential market. And so that's been very gratifying to see. And I think, those are the types of companies that we're trying to find and see if there's anything from that playbook that we can, the success that the founders and the team at Vast have done that we can maybe say, hey, this is what we saw over there. And maybe you can also, take from that playbook as well. And they did an amazing job of attaching the go-to-market to the differentiated technology, which was great to see. The other one is that's been in the news is Silverfort. They raised over $100 million, a cybersecurity company in the identity space, and also a great example of an amazing team, a great technological team that's done a great job scaling, building a great culture. That team, they've been rated the number one startup in Israel to work for 2 years in a row. So I think that's something I don't think I've ever seen. And you can kind of just feel it walking the hallways. And it really permeates the different functions of the business and has allowed them to really scale, because I think being able to transmit certain values from leadership to the edges of the organization is a difficult task the more a company grows. And culture is a tremendous means to get that there, and they're probably the best example that I know of that's really done that in a successful way. And so it's great to see that reflected in business results and therefore funding behind that.
That's awesome. If someone wanted to get partner their startup with Greenfield, what would you recommend them?
Yeah, I would
start talking to 27 months in advance.
Yeah, well, first of all, We try to find them, and so we're doing. We try to have thematic work lead the way. Not every company is operating in a category that is big enough for us to do thematic work on. But obviously, you mentioned cybersecurity. That's a big enough category where there's an infinite amount of work that can be done on broad category and drilling into subcategories. And so we should. It's really on us to know the different pieces that are moving around in each of those ecosystems, whether it's the broader data infrastructure or IT infrastructure, things like that. But if for whatever reason a company is in a stage that's starting to be relevant for us and we haven't spoken to them, we're pretty approachable and easy to get in touch with. Please do reach out, and we'd love to speak with you.
So you're giving examples of how you some of your successful portfolio companies very recently. Tell us more about how you, Greenfield, and General VC support your portfolio companies. And in particular, during the Palestinian atrocities and the war that we're in, obviously a lot of people are called up to reserves. What kind of support do you provide in general and unique during this time?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I touched on a bit earlier in terms of the kind of support and infrastructure we try to build generally. I'll touch on it in 30 seconds now, and then I'll touch on specifically during the war. So I think we've historically been very good around, you know, helping a company establish KPIs, benchmark those KPIs. So all of that transition that I talked about in the business and having everything become much more measurable, which I think is something that not all companies necessarily do at that Series A stage, but which if you want to scale, you have to start doing at some point. We even have head of data, Lior, who can help a company, you know, pull in data from a from their Salesforce or HubSpot into a data warehouse and surface it through a BI tool. And now we've kind of added to that, you know, our operating partner Near, which is, you know, tactical, like how do you actually move those KPIs in a tactical way as opposed to just understanding the KPIs and trying to solve for them. And I think that's been a really powerful combination. So that's just on that, and we can of course double click on that. But you know, post October 7th was a very tricky time, you know, for everyone. I'm personally, of course, and on a business side, I think there was very early on, our position was that if you have to go and help the war effort, you got to go and do what you have to do. But if not, it's actually even more important for those to, just like we're expecting the people who are on the front line to do their best, that we have to go above and beyond in our own work, because that's also what's going to ultimately be best for the country and the economy. And my partner Shai was in Israel, and he said, I want to go see everybody in person. I want to be in every single office. And he then went to New York and flew to the States and any office in the States. And we went around to our portfolio companies, and just I think the act of being there physically was meaningful.
Explain, how did they find that so meaningful? The fact that, was it because what they read in the news and this and that, in a sense, gave a sense of worry? Or like what did they need from him personally that they couldn't get over Zoom?
Yeah, it was probably a little bit psychological. Like, it was very heady times. I don't know, you probably remember.
Crazy,
it was just people weren't exactly sure, you know, what exactly to do with, you know, are people coming into the office? Are people not coming into the office? What should the company's policy be? And so also our operating partner, Nir, put together a board on Monday, here's your resiliency checklist and all sorts of things to be thinking about, of, you know, even as small as, like, do your key people have a backup to their internet? Do they have internet in their safe rooms? All these things to be thinking about to ensure business resiliency. We put it out for portfolio companies, but the broader ecosystem as well. And I think sometimes, look, not everything, you know, I think kind of visiting the companies in person, it's, you know, just about, you know, that personal touch, you know, nothing more than that. I can't say it's part of some, you know, actual tactical, you know, but I think at that point it was important. There are not a lot of times like that you face, hopefully, right? You know, it's a once in a lifetime type of situation, which is, you know, everyone kind of coming out of this trauma. And there was a tremendous amount of dissonance, if you remember, between like, how am I actually, like, I'm sitting at a desk and working my 9-to-5 3 days after this. It's like, didn't make any sense. I think the dissonance is still like slightly there in these random moments during the day, but I think generally people are kind of compartmentalizing pretty well now. But I think at the time it did take a little bit of pushing through that dissonance in order to kind of do what ultimately I think we felt was the right thing to do for ourselves. And I think, I think a lot of the founders and employees of those companies ultimately agreed, and they were really amazing. I mean, I think somehow, you know, Q4 actually was a really strong quarter for our portfolio companies, and I've heard actually even more widely for the ecosystem. And part of it, I'm sure, has to do with macro effects, but I think it's to the credit of the companies and the people who work there for obviously stepping up during a difficult time, and they really deserve a lot of credit.
How much of that do you think changes going forward?
I hope that we're feeling a lot of people coming back from reserve duty. And so I think the effect is being felt less by companies. And I hope that continues, right? Obviously, there is a certain amount of uncertainty, but I think one thing is sure that people are seeing, and I'm getting these comments from many people around the world, is that it's just remarkable to see how resilient Israelis are and the Israeli ecosystem is. So And we're obviously seeing it firsthand. I don't think that's going to change one iota.
Awesome. So when you get into venture capital, like you have a background in investment, if I remember everything from PwC and Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
Maybe you can talk about early career for you. Maybe there are just some younger men and women watching this saying, you know, I'm interested in the space. I want to learn more. My questions are kind of, what was your experience there? So people can have some advice. So, is that a good place to start if they want to get into VCs? Should they get into VCs?
So
we can talk about your early career, having in mind an audience that might also be interested in learning or potentially moving in the direction of your industry.
Yeah, I hope there are people who are, you know, young and watching this and who, you know, I could just share that I personally never had a plan and I didn't.
Is that the best plan? Because I never had a plan either. It's like my seventh industry.
I think there are advantages to that. We could talk about that.
But yeah, sure.
There are also disadvantages. I think, you know, my wife is the opposite example. She knew from when she was a young age what she wanted to do, and that's informed her career really well as well. You know, I never had a plan, and I think that, if you just kind of work hard and orient yourself in a direction to kind of be productive, work with great people, and try to find interesting things to do, again, within a certain, you know, range, I think, you can start to find things that interest you more, right? So I studied English literature in college, and so maybe not the typical track to, you know, eventually, before working in VC, the longest tenure I had was, I was at Goldman Sachs Investment Banking for almost 7 years. It was a great fit. I met the team there. And I remember, you know, I was in kind of process with a consulting firm as well. And I just had such a great click with the team that the culture there was the Israel office of the Goldman Sachs investment banking team. And I just enjoyed my time there so much. The hours are crazy. And I ended up spending a couple of years on the capital market side in London. But it was just a good fit, and it's hard to know in advance. And then in 2018, I was introduced to Shai from Greenfield, and you know, the first call, and you know, obviously met Yuda and felt that alignment of values. And the first call I made was to Raz, who was at another investment bank, and we had worked together on a project for about a year, and I knew he was someone that would be great to bring into the fund. And so it's really worked out. I'm very grateful, and I also would highlight the element that, you know, luck and fortune had to do with it. I think that you always need an element of that, and very grateful for that element as well.
Awesome. So I find that when it comes to investment banking and finance, Israel is extremely underdeveloped. Why do you think that is?
I think it's changing. Definitely more sophisticated than it was.
Uh-huh. I feel like there's such an opportunity that we miss. Because I study finance, right?
Yeah.
And then I also got my MBA from Bar-Ilan, and then I actually interviewed at KPMG in Tel Aviv in like 2009.
Yeah.
Many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And 2010, actually.
Okay.
And I found that it was like the pay was a joke.
Yeah.
And it was a huge schlep, and it was very underdeveloped, and there wasn't really any career opportunities from it. So I decided not to go that route.
Yeah.
And I just thought, because no one really has, we're the only free market in the Middle East.
Yeah.
London and New York seem to be going towards communism. They're not helping their industry, but they're so well, right? Because a lot of finance in New York, they're moving to Florida.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
they're like, true. They like their headquarters and their operating headquarters, in a sense, right? So I was wondering if you think that there was an opportunity here and what's stopping us, and maybe people can speak more about the investment finance, not VC per se, if you had anything to share there.
Yeah, I think it's. It's like, I think there's two elements. One, I think, is more prone to change than the other. So one element is kind of sophistication of the financial industry and all of that. And, you know, companies being open to those types of things. I think that's changing. You know, I think we definitely saw, over at least my period at Goldman, you know, what I saw up until 2018 was a positive trend. I think that's continuing. And you have, you know, expats coming back and, you know, getting into these companies that are maybe a little bit more old school and more open
nice.
To kind of these new ideas. The part that's harder to change, I think, is like a little bit of a scale issue. So if you think about, like the size of a company that for which, you know, these types of more advanced financial services will be relevant is has to be above a certain size. And, you know, the size of the Israeli economy is such that if it's just a local company, you're not going to have a ton of them. So if you think about like a pyramid, like, you know, a big chunk is going to be those smaller companies, and you're only going to have some companies at the top. Whereas if you look at the U.S., there's going to be so many more. And so, you know, I think it's even more on like a ratio basis. So it's just structurally going to be a little bit less fertile for these types of financial services than a place like the U.S. I don't know how much that changes, but the economy is growing and the population is growing, definitely more than almost any other Western
literally
nation.
More yeah. than any other so, way. You know, it's an interesting yeah. stat I heard. The Jewish woman in Israel is the only woman that has more children than her mother.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's interesting.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
And an interesting big component, I don't know, this isn't that relevant, but it actually is, because this is why it's so optimistic about Israeli economy
yeah.
and the tech. One of the things was that a lot of Jews that moved here from the former Soviet Union, they had 0 to 1 kids, and they became Israeli and had 3 to 4.
Mm,
the four kids.
So the
demographers thought it was going to yeah. be an issue,
yeah.
but they were totally wrong. They're wrong about all yeah. kinds of demographics. Demographics is destiny, but there are big changes a lot. So that was a big component of it. They specifically are having more kids than their moms. Okay, so one of the more interesting parts of your career that I was looking at LinkedIn and I chuckled is you were representing Israel at the UN.
Yeah.
So tell me about the Lion's Den.
Okay. It was a great experience. I was really...
When was this?
This was in 2008, I think, 2008, 2009.
Uh-huh.
The ambassador when I joined was Dan Gillerman,
uh-huh.
absolute legend, and also overlapped a little bit with Dr. Gabriela Shalev, mm-hmm. who was also great to work with. And it was really interesting because I was young and I got to go to the UN every day and had to wear a suit with a tie and sit behind the placard that said Israel and all of that. But I got kind of bored pretty early on because you started to realize that I was working on social and economic issues, and it was interesting, but there was 3-hour-long meetings. Israel wasn't super active in those. So Israel, obviously, on you know different elements, would be a hot-button topic, and you need to go and you know represent Israel and kind of deal with what you call the Lion's Den. In the space that I was in, Israel had seen some amazing initiatives, like obviously agricultural technology and things like that, where they were actually helping the world. But most of the time during these meetings, it was really 3 hours of negotiating resolutions that it was like the U.S., the EU, and what was called the G77, which is a group of developing nations, negotiating sub-clauses of a certain resolution. And eventually I was just like, okay, it's cool. I brought all my friends and family to the Security Council to take pictures on weekends, but okay, I got to find something that I'm, you know, using my brain a bit more. And so it was a good experience, but I was ready to move on.
What was your craziest story there? Do you have one?
The story I love is when Dan Gillerman was a great orator, and there was a strike on Broadway, an actor's strike during that time.
Sounds familiar.
And he spoke in the kind of the Lion's Den, and so he was addressing one of these like one of the crazy biased resolutions against Israel or something, and he said, "I need to get it right. I haven't called this statement in a long time." He said, "Broadway may be on strike, but the theater on the East River is always open for business."
Right.
So he Absolutely. Like he used it, and I thought it was just like I think it was off the cuff. Unless the speechwriter at the time was either Zev Nagel, maybe he gets credit for it. After Zev was a fellow by the name of Toby Frankenstein. Those were great speechwriters there at the time that I was at the mission, so they may get credit for some of the good stuff, good work.
Any, what were your anything you've learned from that position that helped you into your career and venture?
I think I learned a lot from every part of chapter in my life. I think there, did a lot of writing, and. I mentioned the name Zev Nagel, and he was also, we were in university together. He was editor-in-chief of the newspaper, and I was an editor. And I think I studied English literature in college, and I was kind of, at the time, my writing was very I think flowery, informed by you know, literature and things like that. And I think over that time, kind of getting into writing as a tool to convey ideas in a concise manner was a good kind of thing that I think I picked up over that time.
I'm finding that writing is probably one of the most important skills, even though there's AI, not because of the writing per se, but I find those that are the best communicators tend to be those that write well. So even those I work with, many Israelis that, let's say, they're not great, they're great at writing emails, and they can communicate well in writing. And then it might be hard for them verbally, but when it comes to strategically thinking and talking things out, it's clear that they have far more than one may think they're getting verbally.
Yeah.
So I find that probably to be an extremely underrated skill. What are the most important skills when it comes to being in venture capital?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's related to that. And this might be, you know, I think that writing should be very closely connected to clear thinking. I think so clear writing forces you to go through, and I think great writing as well, forces the writer to go through a process of clarifying and cleaning their thinking. And I think in venture, ultimately, when it comes down to, if you think about venture capitalists are paid to do, a lot of it is around that decision-making element where you're taking in a lot of inputs and you're making the decision on the basis of information. And so there's a lot of things that can get mixed into that decision-making clarity that can render it impure. And I think a lot of what I try to focus on in my own thinking, that we try to support that process in our investment committee, is getting the thinking to be as clear as possible for people to be able to present things objectively, recognize biases. It's so easy to get to fall into what, you know, I call relative thinking versus first principle thinking. And so I think that all kind of ties together, and that's why I think writing is an important tool, because if you're going to write something down, needs to be a thought process behind it that kind of clarifies your thinking. And that's why, you know, we write investment memos and things like that. So I would say that clarity of thinking is a really important part of the VC process, especially at our stage when there's a lot more factors, right? I think, you know, earlier stage, I'm sure it's very important, but you have fewer factors to evaluating. You're evaluating the team, the size of the market, the technology or the thesis. You know, we're taking in a lot of different factors that might say something, they might not, right? You're seeing all this information coming back from the market, and you had 10 different expert calls, and you're seeing the performance of the cohorts and the different segments, and you met all the different leadership, right? There's just so much information that you're trying to build a narrative, and you're trying to place an educated bet on the back of, like, you really need to keep that thinking clean.
What other skills are necessary for VC?
I think that related to what I was saying is, like, being able to take in a lot of different factors and condense it and distill it. Some people are better at just, like, going deep on one thing. I think in VC you're taking in a lot from a lot of different places. You have to distill it, which is important, without kind of dropping the ball in different places, chasing everything down, feeling like you got from, like, an 80-20 perspective. You've kind of, like, assessed it and have a view and integrating all of those. I think VC, I was speaking with someone recently, I think it does require a certain amount of well-roundedness. So you can be super smart, you can do all that, but you want to be able to have the people skills that, you know, people want you to sit on their board and they want to catch up with you every so often. And you can, people like, you know, I think for us, at least in our fund, it's a team sport. People work well together. So I think it requires a certain amount of well-roundedness as well.
What do people get wrong from the outside? Because I know people, I've heard people make, right? I studied finance. I worked a little bit at Morgan Stanley many, many years ago. Oh my God, almost 20 years ago. It was like 18 years ago. And so what people thought from the outside isn't exactly what is on the inside. What are some misconceptions? What are some assumptions do you think people will have wrong when it comes to the industry?
Yeah, I'm not, I don't know. I know they can... Every once in a while, I see, like, on Twitter and how, like, the U.S. VC, you know, the perceptions and all that, and not really up to speed on what people think. But I think it's if people have a perception that it's, you know, maybe not, you know, this like this, you know, I know in finance, wasn't banking, it was like this alien universe to a lot of people. And but when you're walking the halls, and it's just people at the end of the day, like anything else, and it's an aggregation of people, and everyone I think is trying to do their best and you know, work together. You know, the way I view our fund as a business that I think get a lot of gratification in building the business and building the team and trying to be great at what we do. And so, you know, if people have different impressions, you know, but that's kind of how I view it.
So earlier we were off camera, we were talking about intellectual dishonesty. And this is, I think, a lot of things that's been coming up in general that you're seeing. People saying one thing, they're not necessarily honest or sincere, or they say things, they don't act integrous in a sense.
Yeah.
So I thought you kind of had maybe some interesting things to share. And you some, obviously, this is a pet peeve of yours, as it is for most people. What is the most common form of intellectual dishonesty that you see in tech?
You're putting me on the spot. I think we're talking more generally about...
Or generally. Or in business. You don't have to call anyone out.
No, I think that sometimes... I think what's tricky about intellectual dishonesty is that it's often unintentional. And people will kind of convince themselves of something and stick behind it and advocate as if it's the truth, you know, primarily because it aligns with their interest as opposed to really trying to get to the ultimate truth of the matter. You know, so maybe it relates to what we were discussing earlier about, you know, being a good investor and, you know, finding that truth. And so, yeah, it's just a, you know, pet peeve when I, you know, I think, you know, we were talking about earlier, you know, just for one reason or another, and maybe it relates to, I'm actually like a descendant on my mom's side from some great rabbi who was known for truth. You know, for any of the followers who might know, it's the rabbi from a city called Kotsk. And he was known for his ultimate, you know, goal that he advocated among his disciples was, you know, striving for truth. And any, you know, anything that deviated from that in someone's personal or spiritual life or was viewed negatively. And so I don't know, maybe it somehow came through the generations as something that, you know, I feel strongly in me as well, I guess.
Do you think in business, a lot of people, they're not able to see the truth? I mean, we all have our biases, we're all humans, we're all programmed, not just from adolescence, but probably every day from the media and from our relationships, et cetera. What do you think in business, people avoid the truth, or they have blind spots to it, or there's intellectual inconsistencies, not saying that they're intentional.
Yeah.
Where do you think we see the most? Where are the greatest blind spots? You work with so many entrepreneurs.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, assessing ourselves, because, you know, we're talking about what are the reasons for intellectual dishonesty, you know, usually when it diverges from a personal interest. And, you know, probably the strongest personal interest is around personal identity. And I think, you know, we have personal identity conflates with company identity to a degree. And so...
What do you mean? Can you elaborate?
That, you know, I think people feel like if... sometimes they can feel that if the company's not doing poorly, you know, they have their own identity maybe wrapped up in it a little bit. And
you
so...
You mean if they're not doing... The company is doing poorly.
Is doing poorly. Yeah. Right. Sorry, okay. I misspoke there. If the company is doing poorly, they may feel like it reflects on them. And so they're kind of subconsciously might be oriented towards being slightly intellectually dishonest about the reality of the situation and what might need to be done. And I think that, yeah.
Because so, they don't want, because they wrap that up with their identity, and their identity is not that. They can't compartmentalize that. I think I'm doing great, the business is doing poorly. They can't separate the two.
I think there's potential, right? And It's tough to, you know, we're getting into very, you know, amorphous subjects, but I think that, you know, touches on the fact that, you know, as a founder, it's supremely important to be an optimist. And so what's the difference between being an optimist and being slightly intellectually dishonest about reality?
Right.
Right. Maybe that's actually can be a good quality in some ways. So it kind of exists on a spectrum. And so it's a little bit, you know, less tangible. But.
Should this literally came up in our interview this morning.
Okay.
That
entrepreneurs are too optimistic and too much will not discuss the challenges and the negatives with their teams, with their VCs, with their whomever. And he thought that this was a challenge of finding happiness as a founder and being able to build intimacy within your team. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I could try to, like, I have a little bit of now inside scoop into how things look from, my wife's a founder as of the last year or so.
Uh-huh.
And I think there needs to be a little bit of a gap between, you know, the internal mess that's sometimes happening and what a founder needs to project outside, because there is some, you know, chaos that's reigning, and the founder's job is to rein in the chaos, and it's okay. And I don't expect every founder to say, you know, share all the ins and outs with all the tough things that are happening, because, you know, they have to manage it, you know, just like, you know, I'm not talking with the founder about how I'm managing things with our employees and our investors and all and our and all of that and other portfolio companies. So I think it's okay. You don't need to, it's not being dishonest in any way to not reflect all of the challenges that are happening. Obviously, if there are big enough challenges that are, you know, relate to the ability for the company to deliver on what it's saying, that needs to be disclosed. But I do think it's okay to have a little bit of an air gap between, you know, the full extent of all of the gory detail of what's going on in the company and what's projected. I mean, think about it with the dating, you know, if, you know, people, it takes time to build that intimacy before we're kind of wearing everything on our sleeves and et cetera. And eventually you're kind of more clued into everything that's happening. So I think it's okay. And I think that, you know, I'd probably agree with Yoni about, you know, some of the, you know, in some cases there probably should be a little bit more of an ability to, you know, maybe he's referring to where companies feel like they can't, they want to discuss something and maybe they can't. And that's a case where I really hope that, you know, all the, you know, founders that we work with feel comfortable. So I think that's an important one to make sure that there is that trust and the comfort there to share stuff that's a bit more challenging.
We touched on this a little bit, like you meet so many founders and entrepreneurs. You discussed red flags in investing. But maybe you can talk maybe some aspirational direction or focus that in general you think are lacking from founders and what they can do maybe to help themselves improve so they can learn from watching this.
Yeah, look, at our stage, it's really a lot driven by results, right? So so there's stuff that obviously that relates to building the vision and all of that. But for our stage, we're gonna have to already see certain results in the market, a team that's able to, there's already a machine that's working in order to drive business. There's a certain amount of business coming in and the way it's performing. So, you know, that takes a lot of work in advance of that. So I would just say probably some of the things that lead to that are being able to really listen to the customer, being able to kind of build through the phases that allow them to get to the point where they're raising a Series B or a Series C. And I'm not saying necessarily to listen to the customer and build exactly what they ask for, but really understand the pain point that of the customer in order to build a product that will address the pain in a way that it might be the way they ask for it to be built. It might be in a different way. But they're that ultimately they've built a company that is clearly solving a problem where there's indications from the market are clearly signals beyond just the logic of the thesis, but actually signals from the market that there's pull on their product and that they've built the organization to support the next level of scale. They haven't gotten there with, you know, they're completely out of breath and, you know, the thing's about to break, but rather they're building the company with an eye towards the future and not just kind of sacrificing the long-term for short-term expedience. So those are a few things that come to mind, you know, immediately.
No bullshit answer. At what point do you think a founder, when they've successfully grown a company, stereotypically speaking, is like time for them, hey, like, you did amazing. This company's too big and those set of skills, generally speaking, don't apply to the founding entrepreneur. And then maybe it's time for you to move on and start something else again and take a bunch of money with you and equity and all of that. Is there a certain stage, generally speaking, that you think that is time to kind of like the founding, you know, team, that it's a different skill set, and that, you know, I'm curious if do you, that different skill, the founders, like their skills kind of has a ceiling.
I think you see in the best companies, founders are really important parts for a very long time.
Right.
Like they're important, like 15 years is probably a good number for how long in a company's lifetime the founding team is important. Now, that's like the goal, and what we really have that in mind when we invest in companies. But at some point, there are times where, you know, the numbers, the performance will indicate otherwise, and it's probably worth having a conversation together with the founder to see whether,
you know. Come on, give me an answer. At what point do you think that a certain amount of revenue, a certain amount of growth, a certain amount of expansion to different nationalities, starting to serve, you know, different languages, when you're like, at what point do you think, generally speaking, that you've got the most you could out of a founder?
I don't think there's an upper limit. I mean, look who's, okay. Look at, you know, Elon Musk.
Elon Musk is the exception of everything.
No, I think there's some pretty big public companies still being run by their founders. So it's really just at what point you hit your ceiling. And it could be 10 years into being a public company, and it could be you get tired at that point. But
right.
Then I think that, you know, one of the things I've learned really from some of our, you know, CEOs, I think, Renan from Vast comes to mind, is just this question of like, what's best for the company? It really kind of puts to bed a lot of bickering,
right,
and things where ego gets involved. It's like, what's best for the company? And hopefully,
it's kind of like parenting.
Yeah.
What's best for the kids?
There you go. Like, exactly. What's best for the kids? What's best for the company? And then it's like, okay, everyone should put their egos on the side and say,
right,
and be objective about it, and have that, you know, intellectual honesty and humility, and say, okay, well, what is best for the company? What will allow it to achieve its potential? And in that situation, it might be time. But I don't think there's a definite cap on it.
Uh-huh. Awesome. And for those that are looking, founders that might be worried about bringing in a VC, bringing in board members, and certainly they have accountability to people outside of the organization that aren't as invested with their equity, their sweat, their time, right? They're in a sense, and they're involved in many others. You're on the board in several companies. Tell me, like, is the thing that they should know or keep in mind when they're doing that? It feels like it's difficult to go ahead and, let's say, you know, bring someone from the outside in to support and help you grow, even though that other person isn't nearly as involved and invested as the founder has been.
Yeah, that's why I think it's important for both sides to get to know one another for a long time, build that trust. And look, I think there's a responsibility they bear to themselves, to the company, to their families, to understand like what the structure of accepting VC company means and where the interests can potentially diverge. And they should be speaking with, you know, friends of theirs who, you know, they can actually discuss, you know, what the interests of, you know, how, you know, all those potential corner cases, and maybe discuss them with the VC up front if there is something to discuss. But I really think that it's very hard to solve for everything in the, you know, in a contract or in, you know, it's really, that's why we really believe in alignment of values, because that's what's going to ultimately dictate things that are not in, you know, black on white in a contract. And you want to make sure that, okay, if we get into a point where interests diverge, can we all be above board about it, and can we solve it in a way that's a win-win for everybody, as opposed to, you know, one side driving for a, you know, winner-take-all type of approach.
Awesome. If people want to stay up to date on what's going on with you, Avery, and for Greenfield, where should they go?
We have a weekly newsletter called the Greenfield Crunch. You can probably find it on our website.
We'll put it in the description below for those seeing it.
Our website is greenfield-growth.com. Feel free to also follow us on LinkedIn. We put a lot of content out there.
We'll put all your social, your personal, and
sure,
we'll put Greenfield.
Fantastic.
As well as Israel Tech in the description. Any final say you want to say to the audience?
No, appreciate it. I want to thank you, Yoel and the Israel Tech team for coming by, for doing the interview. I think you guys are doing something really great for the ecosystem, and hope everyone continues to watch and follow you guys.
That means a lot. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much.